This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. It is very good to have you listening to Trumpet Hour today. I'm Joel Hilliker. We hear a lot these days about systemic racism, that this is the reason for disparities between ethnic minorities, disparities in education, income, crime statistics, many other areas. Well, this narrative has been promoted by the left in America and in many other countries. The British government set up a commission to examine whether Britain was in fact institutionally racist. Now, this commission just released its findings last week, and mainstream media did not like it at all. But I want to talk about why this should be headline news. It should get a whole lot more attention than it did, and you need to know about it. In our second segment, nuclear talks with Iran started in Vienna yesterday, with several nations supposedly working to try to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. Well, there's evidence that all this could be an elaborate fraud, because Iran already has nuclear weapons. This is a frightening possibility and one that is a lot more plausible than you'd expect. We're going to hear a report about this from Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. In our third segment, we'll talk about vaccine passports. This could well be a necessity if you want to participate in many elements of modern life, including working in many businesses, using public transportation, going to restaurants, and so on. Governments around the world are planning to combat COVID-19 using an unprecedented level of surveillance of their citizens. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this. Then we'll finish today's program with a last word about a thought I had after going 1 month without a drop of coffee. Let's start now by talking about this report on institutional racism. Last year, Black Lives Matter protests swept through America. They brashly argued that systemic racism was holding down black people, even killing them. This movement gained mainstream acceptance among America's elites, who embraced its basic premise. And it also spread to many other countries. Protest movements in several nations expressed common cause with America's BLM community, making similar accusations about racism in their own countries. In the United Kingdom, the Boris Johnson government responded by setting up an official investigation into structural racism in Britain. There were 10 people on the government commission. 9 of them came from an ethnic minority. The team was led by a black man named Dr. Tony Sewell. Here's a short biography of him from Spiked Online. Born in Brixton in 1959 to Jamaican parents, much of Sewell's adolescence was spent in church-led youth activities in and around Sydenham. In his later years, he delivered a highly impactful PhD thesis on black masculinities and schooling that led to several key publications. He's helped to transform education in Hackney, and he eventually founded the groundbreaking charity Generating Genius. Generating Genius has been successful in providing disadvantaged young people a route to some of the UK's top universities. Through the charity's activities, Sewell has worked tirelessly to ensure that talented ethnic minority students are well positioned to excel in careers in the science and technology sectors. So this is the man who oversaw this commission. It seems that the British government went out of its way to have an honest self-assessment of the problems of racism in Britain. And really, you'd think that this commission, which was asked specifically to identify systemic racism, would have found plenty of evidence of that. But the report the commission produced did not find what many people expected. This is a quote from the report's foreword that sums up its conclusions. Put simply, we no longer see a Britain where the system is deliberately rigged against ethnic minorities. The impediments and disparities do exist. They are varied, and ironically, very few of them are directly to do with racism. Too often, racism is the catch-all explanation and can be simply implicitly accepted rather than explicitly examined. The report says that accusations of institutional racism are thrown around too often. And really, they should only be used where there's actual evidence of that. It says the evidence shows that geography, family influence, socioeconomic background, culture, and religion have more significant impact on life chances than the existence of racism. That said, we take the reality of racism seriously, and we do not deny that it is a real force in the UK. Now, as you might imagine, this overarching conclusion of this government report that Britain is in fact not systemically racist, not rigged against minorities, and that charges of racism shouldn't be accepted without scrutiny, this has caused the radical left in Britain to go completely bananas. They are unhinged in their condemnations of the people behind this report and this report's findings. The commission chairs, Tony Sewell, again, this man is black. He's been compared to the Ku Klux Klan. Spiked Online says this: even before the report's publication, lawyer and political activist Dr. Shola Moshogbamimu, one of the most toxic voices in Britain's race relations debate, branded Sewell a token black man who is responsible for gaslighting the entire nation through, quote, a white supremacist lie. University of Cambridge academic and race-baiting supremo Professor Priyam Vadagopal questioned Sewell's qualifications for undertaking the research. After conceding that Sewell did in fact have a research doctorate, Gopal said that even Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda Reich minister of Nazi Germany, had a PhD. An assortment of left-wing identitarian bigots on social media have hurled racially motivated abuse at Sewell, calling him a coon, coconut, race traitor, and house Negro. And this author says, I'm no stranger to this type of identitarian abuse, but even I have been taken aback by the tsunami of racial abuse from the supposedly anti-racist left. The Guardian also published an article March 31st condemning this report, and it said that the report's purpose was to whitewash the problems of racism in Britain. Now, none of this condemnation pointed to flaws in the report. It didn't address any of the facts presented by the report. It didn't give a reasoned refutation of any of the report's conclusions. It just descended with a lot of emotion and anger. And the argument is essentially the fact that you deny there is racism is concrete evidence that you are racist. The fact that this commission can't recognize racism is proof that they are part of the problem. And we'll talk about why this is such a monumental problem in a bit. But first, I want to look at more of the really the good news in this commission's findings. Spiked called it a landmark piece of research. While advancing the view that racism remains a real force in the UK, it correctly states that Britain has made considerable progress over the past 50 years when it comes to race relations. Now, that's good news, isn't it? Why wouldn't this be something that everyone could agree on and celebrate? This report rejected racism as a cause of higher COVID deaths among ethnic minorities. Isn't that good news? That wasn't the cause? The Telegraph said this report finds no evidence that institutional racism exists in Britain. In fact, it points out that in some areas, such as education, particular ethnic minorities outperform their white counterparts. Even more boldly, it ventures that the UK should be seen as a model for other white majority nations. Isn't that good news? That Britain could actually be held up as a model for other nations in this important aspect of modern life? This is from the Telegraph as well. Tony Sewell, the Brixton-born educationalist who led the commission, is trying to shift the debate away from victimizing meta-theories towards a more nuanced discussion about race. His investigation is barbed with inconvenient facts. The ethnic pay gap has shrunk to 2.3% overall and barely registers for employees under 30. Diversity is improving in professions like medicine and law. Now, this is all good news for people who are actually wanting to see improvements in race relations. But clearly, that is not what the left actually wants. They actually want to continue to divide people. and use race as a weapon to do so. This commission spoke out against all the rhetoric that unfairly accuses people of racism. This is a paragraph from the report's introduction. Just as racist behavior and racist messages are being amplified, so are accusations of racism that are harder to prove, open to interpretation, or even vexatious. The internet has also exposed the problems inherent in a subjective definition of a racist incident. We can have a situation where the exact same action can be racism or not racism, depending on how someone perceives it. This means there is no clarity or consistency in identifying examples. It is now possible for any act, including those intended to be well-meaning, to be classified as racist. Without clearer definitions, it will be harder to measure the true extent of racism. This is so true, where they're exalting my truth, my perception of things as being the actual truth. If you feel something, it is truth. It's just impossible to have a standard for measuring what is actually racist when that is your standard, when it varies depending on who's looking at the situation. This report called for a limiting of the widening charge of racism. And it shows that there are actually a lot of problems that emerge when you allow these widespread accusations, or when we treat racism the way that we are today. Just to take one example, it talks about the effect of all of these accusations on the police. The commission found that there's actually a need to protect police officers who are of a minority, protect them from racism from people in their own communities who view them as traitors. The report says ethnic minority police officers are also experiencing racist abuse from citizens they serve, including from those in their own ethnic minority groups. Racist assaults against police officers in the Metropolitan Police Service almost doubled between the year ending November 2019 and November 2020. This and the increasing assaults are issues that seem to be overlooked in the public discourse and seldom discussed with veracity when it comes to police actions or police service recruitment. Yet they both, in the commission's view, have an impact on addressing entrenched disparities and improving outcomes for all concerned. So this is encouraging bridging minority communities and the police together and trying to resolve these issues in ways that reduce the amount of racial hatred in communities, rather than just automatically buying into all of the defund the police rhetoric and saying that basically all race problems are going one direction, and that's from whites against blacks or against minorities. This shows that it's a lot more nuanced than that. There's a lot more going on that impact a lot of people. And the idea that you have to protect these racial minorities that are serving the public in the police force against their own communities because of the way that they view them, this is quite extraordinary. If you're going to address problems in society, you have to correctly identify the problems. If you're just attributing everything to racism and your definition of that is so narrow and the problems are not caused by that, you're never going to solve those problems. Here's another important finding from the report. It found that family background is much more significant than race in influencing a person's chance for success in life. And it says that family breakdown is one of the main reasons for the problems in society. It points out the fact that 2/3 of Black Caribbean children grow up in one-parent homes in Britain. 2/3. The report says in many areas of investigation, including educational failure and crime, we were led to family breakdown as one of the main reasons for poor outcomes. Family is also the foundation stone of success for many ethnic minorities. So if you're going to address disparities in income and crime statistics and other measures of success or failure, then you must try to strengthen the family. You need to look at how to strengthen marriages and how to improve parenting and how to get fathers to do their job as leaders and providers and protectors and how to get mothers to do their job in devoting themselves to their children. You need to look at how to keep families together and make them successful so that they raise responsible citizens. But these are all issues the left is completely unwilling to look at. They just want to view everything through the lens of race. And if people don't succeed, well, there's only one explanation for why that's the case. Part of the report's conclusion says this: we were established, this commission was established as a response to the upsurge of concern about race issues instigated by the BLM movement. And we owe these mainly young people behind that movement a debt of gratitude for focusing our attention once again on these issues. But most of us come from an older generation whose views were formed by growing up in the 1970s and 1980s. And our experience has taught us that you do not pass on the baton of progress by cleaving to a fatalistic account that insists nothing has changed. And nor do you move forward by importing bleak new theories about race that insist on accentuating our differences. It is closer contact, mutual understanding across ethnic groups, and a shared commitment to equal opportunities that has contributed to the progress we have made. That's a pretty common sense conclusion, and it's pretty refreshing to read, I guess, in contrast to what you're hearing in the mainstream about race. So often we hear about how we need to have this conversation about race as a society, as if this is going to solve all of the problems. But the reality is, the more we talk about this, at least in the terms that BLM and some of these other groups that think this way, the way the radical left views it, the more we talk about it on their terms, the more divided we become. The way the left talks about this does not solve problems. Going around finding racism under every rock and within the inner heart of every white person, this does not improve race relations. I want to just read a paragraph from this Spiked article about the chair of that commission. It says, the reality is that this country, Britain, owes a great deal to the likes of Dr. Tony Sewell. Time and again, he is willing to put his neck on the line by shedding light on uncomfortable truths. He's sticking his head above the parapet for the greater common good. He has encouraged many to exercise personal responsibility and individual initiative in order to overcome adversity and to progress in life. And in doing so, he's been accused of being an establishment sellout and betraying the, quote, racial justice cause by identitarian grievance mongers who would like to keep all non-white people locked in a perpetual condition of miserable victimhood. That is expressed very, very well. That effort to keep people locked in victimhood is terribly damaging. The fact is, everyone faces adversity in life. Everyone of every race. And God wants us to work individually, to rise above that, to take personal responsibility and individual initiative to overcome adversity, to develop and grow. He wants us individually building strong families, raising strong children, and children that are resilient and that are skilled at, they develop over time on how to overcome adversity. These people who want to say, look, the way to solve all of these problems, the way to make sure that everybody can be successful is if somehow society changes to accommodate them, they are stripping people of their power of choice. They're trapping people in failure with that kind of thinking. This is again from Spiked. Sewell is ultimately guilty, quote unquote, of being a high-achieving black British man who does not hesitate to call out the deeply regressive elements of the left's tribal racial identity politics. While this makes him a pariah among those who are financially and emotionally invested in the identitarian industrial complex, he is appreciated by those who are genuinely interested in the facts on the ground and how this information can be used to design more effective social policies for modern-day Britain. Now, this story of this commission, it's not going to get a lot of attention in the mainstream media because they're so committed to the BLM narrative about systemic racism and institutional corruption that is holding minorities down. But it's a terrible shame. This story should get a lot of attention. Reports like this, this commission from Britain, expose that narrative for the lie that it is. Reports like this show that it is nothing more than an effort to divide society using accusation and emotion and blame shifting rather than facts. Reports like this point to actual solutions to some of the problems in society. And most importantly, they give people tools to take personal responsibility to improve their own lives. That really is good news.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Iran has been working toward building nuclear weapons for many years. There's evidence, though, that it may well already have nuclear weapons and is benefiting from preserving the lie that it doesn't have them yet, as we will now hear in this report from Brent Noctegal.
On Tuesday, the highly anticipated nuclear renegotiations between the Biden administration and Iran finally began in Vienna. And as with the last set of talks that culminated in the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, it's already obvious that although the United States holds all the leverage, it's Iran who will come out on top. Iran wants to reinstate the deal that President Obama's team negotiated with little desire to make it tougher. In essence, this means undoing the economic sanctions imposed by President Trump in return for the promise of halting their nuclear weapons program, at least for the next 4 or 5 years. Now, luckily for Iran, the same cast that negotiated the deal for Obama are back in the room with the same Iranians. Well, not back in the room exactly. As per the initial protocol of Tuesday's negotiations, the United States is in one room, the Iranians in the other, and the Europeans dutifully shuttling messages between them. Representing Iran is Abbas Araki, the deputy foreign minister who reports to the ever-smiley Javad Zarif. On the American side is Robert Malley, Obama's point man on the 2015 accord. The last time around, Obama's team agreed to a deal that would limit Iran's overt nuclear program for a decade. All the while, $150 billion of unfrozen cash would be wired to Iran, as well as $1.8 billion in cash that jetted to Iran coinciding with the release of American hostages. This time, there's about $30 billion US dollars that would be unfrozen on day one of the deal, and at the same time, President Trump's sanctions would come down, giving Iran open access to international markets. Now, there have been some rumors that the United States will try and harden the deal to include Iran's work on ballistic missile testing, the very delivery system for a nuclear weapon, as well as limiting some of Iran's other malign activities. But given the Obama team's track record, there is little chance of that happening. Yet, with all the talk of the specifics of the nuclear deal, there's also the eerie sense that the whole scene in Vienna is but a show, simply a cover for the United States to justify its foreign policy shift towards empowering Iran rather than containing it. Obama wanted to empower Iran in 2015 and did so with the nuclear deal, and now in 2021, Obama's men are back to finish what they started. The United States is not negotiating against Iran. They are simply seeking to justify to the world the fundamental realignment of American Middle East foreign policy with the number one state sponsor of terrorism. Obama wants Iran to have the money to fund its jihad, and the nuclear agreement is a way to provide cover for this ambition. Now, the notion that the nuclear negotiations are fraudulent becomes even more believable when considering that Iran may already have nuclear weapons. On March 19th, the National Review published a piece entitled "Iran Probably Already Has the Bomb, Here's What to Do About It." The article goes through a series of points to show that it's highly likely that Iran is already in possession of nuclear weapons. This article is not some pie-in-the-sky fantasy written by the uninformed. Instead, it holds the byline of five distinguished intelligence specialists. Listed first is the former director of the CIA, Ambassador R. James Woolsey. I want to take you through some lengthy quotes from this esteemed article, and it should be chilling for you. Quote, "We assess from UN International Atomic Energy Agency reports and other sources that Iran probably already has nuclear weapons. Prior to 2003, Iran was manufacturing nuclear weapons components, like bridge wire detonators and neutron initiators, performing non-fissile explosive experiments of an implosion nuclear device, and working on the design of a nuclear warhead for the Shahab-3 missile. When our World War II Manhattan project reached this stage, the US was only months away from making its first atomic bomb. And this was Iran's status 18 years ago. So by 2003, Iran was already a threshold nuclear missile state." Now, as the article brings out, the official line is that Iran is about 3 months away from its first nuclear weapon if it decided to break out, and about 5 months before it gets its second. However, that is just based on Iran's overt nuclear program. The IAEA and the US intelligence agencies have had a long, poor track record at being a watchdog for nuclear development. The IAEA inspectors failed to discover clandestine nuclear weapons programs in North Korea, Pakistan, Iraq, and Libya. And so it stands to reason that the IAEA inspectors that we base our understanding of Iran's nuclear program on are fundamentally flawed. This is also due to the fact that the IAEA inspectors are limited to civilian sites in Iran. They're restricted from military bases, including several highly suspicious underground facilities where Iran's nuclear-related weapons program almost certainly continues clandestinely. This article also brings out that Iran can build sophisticated nuclear weapons by relying on component testing without nuclear testing, meaning that while the world is waiting for Iran to have a nuclear test to show that they have a nuclear weapon, that's not normally the way that a nation becomes nuclear capable. The United States, Israel, Pakistan, and India all use component testing approach. So just because we haven't seen Iran with a bomb doesn't mean they don't have all the necessary parts to build one. The other problem with our intelligence assessment is that the intelligence community uses an in-country nuclear test as confirmation that that country, including Iran, has developed nuclear weapons. But for Iran, we should be looking elsewhere. Iran and North Korea have extremely close relations. Iranian scientists have been present during North Korea's nuclear tests. North Korea could have easily exchanged information with Iran and even tested an Iranian nuclear weapon as well as their own, but in North Korea rather than Iran. And so this means that Iran may have nuclear weapons already, but that they were just being tested in North Korea. So if all this is the case, so if this article is correct and Iran has a nuclear weapon, why don't they come out and tell the world? Why don't they behave like North Korea? It has several reasons of why Iran might not do that. And one of them is especially concerning. It says this, "Moreover, Iran wants to preserve the fiction of its non-nuclear status. It has derived far more economic and strategic benefits from the JCPOA or the nuclear deal and threats to go nuclear than has North Korea from going nuclear overtly." Then they conclude this way. "Ominously, Iran may be forgoing the deterrence benefits of an overt nuclear posture because it is currently building towards a surprise future employment of nuclear capabilities to advance the global theological agenda of the Ayatollahs and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the world's largest and most sophisticated terrorist organization." And this is the most stunning part of the article. The authors posit that Iran may not be coming clean that it has nuclear weapons right now because it's waiting. It's waiting to build enough of a nuclear arsenal to actually go ahead and surprise the world with their use. And such a surprise as that would fit well with biblical prophecy.
Thanks for that, Brent. Very concerning. Now, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has pointed to Iran seeking nuclear weapons for decades now, and he has pointed to why this is so dangerous, considering the role that Iran plays in end-time biblical prophecy. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this does get really to the heart of why Iran is specifically the most dangerous actor to that we would consider to hold nuclear weapons, because they aren't governed by the same cost benefit that other nations might be. Other nations, a lot of them, would like nuclear weapons for a deterring effect on others attacking them. They see it as a defense mechanism. And the doctrine, the Cold War doctrine of mutually assured destruction, meaning that if you fire your nuclear weapons at us, we'll fire them back at you and you'll be destroyed also. That doctrine fails to hold up with Iran based on their religion. And this is something that Mr. Fleury focuses on in his book, The King of the South, and also his more recent booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. He talks about how this Twelverism, which is not a fringe belief, this is a part of the Shia version of Islam, and between 90 to 95% of Iran's 80 million people are Shiites, and 85% of those are Twelvers. So that's 60 million Iranians believe that their Mahdi, or their, let's say, their messianic figure, his return is prompted by global chaos. And that does not mean that Iran has to be victorious in this war. It means that Iran has to start it. And this is even something that the late Supreme Leader Khomeini said back at the beginning of the Iranian Revolution. He says, "We do not worship Iran, we worship Allah. For patriotism is another name for paganism. I say, let this land burn. I say, let our land go up in smoke, provided Islam emerges triumphant in the rest of the world." Meaning that we don't mind if our people get toasted. We don't mind if Iran ends up burning because of the use of a nuclear weapon, as long as this chaos that is, and world war that is inflicted upon the world based on an instigation of perhaps a nuclear weapon by Iran, as long as that brings around the Islamic Messiah, then it's worth it. Right. And there isn't another nuclear power right now with that same dangerous ideology. And that is, you know, what these authors were talking about in that concluding statement that they gave, that I read in that report, that maybe Iran is actually preparing to have a stockpile of nuclear weapons to not create a deterring effect, because then they would publish that. They would let everybody know, we have nuclear weapons, we have nuclear weapons. Perhaps they actually intend to use it based on this, the understanding of their belief system.
It's remarkable, considering those kinds of statements that you were just quoting, that American leaders and those of other countries, but particularly America, is willing to do business with Iran, given that reality. But if you look at the biblical prophecies about nuclear war and nuclear weapons being used, it's sure to happen. And in some ways, this scenario that could be playing out with Iran kind of factors into that.
Yeah, there are numerous prophecies that talk about the calamitous third world war, and specifically Matthew 24 verse 21 and 22 talks about how that Jesus Christ is going to have to intervene when this war starts, because no flesh would be saved alive. And that's kind of the situation that exists with a nuclear war. And that's even what Winston Churchill said, that we have developed the technologies to bring about mankind's annihilation. And so that's what would happen if nuclear war does, or when it does actually engulf this world. There is going to have to be a stop that is put to it. And that would actually be not the counterfeit Messiah that the Iranians talk about, but the true Messiah is going to be the one that puts down that that worldwide cataclysm. There's also other prophecies that specifically talk about how when people are saying peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes. And this is in the this is written in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 3. And really, that's what we see in these nuclear negotiations. We see this fake negotiation, if I can call it that, that's meant to put a cap on Iran's weapons when they may already have them. And even if they don't, I mean, the nuclear deal will not put a stop to that indefinitely. And so they're saying peace and safety is there, but really Bible prophecy says that this time, the time of world war, is going to come as a thief in the night. It's going to come suddenly, sudden destruction. And so this kind of scenario that we are witnessing with Iran's nuclear program really does speak to that. And if people want to read more about that, I definitely recommend they do so. They can request Mr. Gerald Fleury's book, A Nuclear Armageddon Is at the Door.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about Iran possibly already having nuclear weapons. He's working on an article on this subject. I would suggest you keep an eye on that. Watch for that at thetrumpet.com and check out that booklet that he mentioned. We'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. Nuclear Armageddon Is at the Door. Thanks so much, Brent.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Is it possible that you will soon need a vaccine passport to participate in modern life? We'll take a look at what governments are doing to bring this reality about in this report from Richard Palmer.
Papers, please. These are perhaps the most un-American or un-British words in the English language. The Western world has prided itself on its love of freedom and absence of government control. But that time could soon be coming to an end. Around the world, governments are planning an unprecedented level of surveillance into their lives of their citizens, all in the name of combating COVID. But this new surveillance society will require no rustling of papers. To bring in the new regime with minimal public fuss, governments are working on the most convenient system of ID and surveillance ever, using smartphones and online tools. But the results are even worse. A government that can track your movements even more effectively than if you are required to hand over physical paperwork for every transaction. Consider what the daily routine of a vaccinated citizen could soon look like. In the morning, you leave for work. You buy a train ticket on your smartphone in order to commute. The ticketing app checks your vaccine status. You're good, so a tissue is issued, allowing you to use one of the more convenient carriages for those that have been vaccinated. Those without the jab must wait in a long queue to use the more limited number of socially distanced carriages. Once you get to work, you scan your security pass to get into the building. Then you scan your COVID vaccine app. Your employer only allows vaccinated staff in the office. No jab, no job. At lunchtime, you leave work to get yourself a sandwich. There's a good coffee shop down the road. Scan the vaccine app and you're in. Scan the app again to get back into the office. You're back at the desk. Now, no need to scan the app when you head to the gym. They checked your vaccine status when you re-enrolled after lockdown. No vaccine, no membership. After heading home to change, you stop by a friend's house party. But even there, you need your vaccine app. Government rules don't allow groups to get together at home unless everyone's vaccinated. By law, your friend has to scan all your vaccine passports. Fortunately, it's easy to do. An app on his smartphone allows him to check everybody's status. The result is a government that knows where you are at every point of the day. They have a level of surveillance and therefore control that until recently even communist China could only have dreamt of. A government record determines if you can work, travel, access entertainment, or gather with friends. Sound far-fetched? Well, it's actually a reasonable picture based on plans currently being drawn up by governments around the world. Some of this is already a reality in the state of Israel. Restaurants and sporting venues are open if you have a vaccine pass. Only then can you stay in hotels, go to the gym, hold a wedding, or attend certain religious gatherings. Teachers are being fired for refusing them and having these terminations upheld by the courts. A director of civil and social rights at the Association for Civil Rights in Israel doesn't see any problem. Anybody who's complaining can get the vaccine tomorrow morning, he said. On April 5th, the UK laid out its plans for vaccine passports. They're planning on requiring these passports to attend concerts, theatres, nightclubs or large sporting events. One of the contractors working on the government's vaccine passports boasts that their app could be used to deny people tickets or entry to work for the unvaccinated. They even show how their product could be used to keep the unvaccinated from private events like birthday parties. And at every stage of this, the UK government has been deceitful. Time and time again, government officials have insisted they would never even think about working on anything so un-British as a vaccine passport. Some form of paperwork might be necessary for international travel, they've said, but never for internal events. In December, Vaccine Minister Nadeem Zahawi said, "We have absolutely no plans for vaccine passporting." He said, "I think mandatory vaccinations is discriminatory and completely wrong. I would urge businesses listening to this debate not to even think about this." Cabinet Minister Michael Gove said, I certainly am not planning to issue any vaccine passports and I don't know anyone in government who would. They were lying. The same month, the consulting firm published a government-commissioned report into how vaccine passports could be used to let only the vaccinated into pubs, sporting events and other crowded venues. Several commentators are now warning that Britain risks becoming a, quote, biosecurity state. And the government seems to be similarly deceptive about the future of vaccine passports. They're insisting that they won't force pubs and restaurants to require the vaccine. But they seem to be set to require these businesses to continue social distancing measures, e.g. keeping people 6 feet apart, unless they check vaccine passports. So if these businesses want to stay in business, they have little choice. The EU is also taking significant steps towards introducing a vaccine passport, and their effort doesn't just involve national tracking. With free travel across many EU borders, they need some kind of supranational system. This means a whole new level of centralization and bureaucracy that has never existed before in Europe. For the first time ever, officials in Brussels are going to be able to track the actions of their citizens, whether they're in Italy, Germany, or Spain. And even in America, plans for vaccine passports are underway. The Biden administration used to say that vaccine passports should be left to the states. But on March 29th, they announced that they were working on setting up a federal standardized system. Around the same time, CNN cited an anonymous government official stating that multiple government agencies are engaged in conversations and planning coordinated by the White House, as this kind of system will play a role in multiple aspects of life, including potentially the workforce. New York is already rolling out their Excelsior Pass, a fancy name for their vaccine passport. This pass will let you into arts and entertainment venues or increase the number of guests that you can have at your wedding if you've been vaccinated or had a recent negative test. Now, the governments have made all kinds of promises about data privacy and lack of tracking ability when it comes to these passports. But how much can you trust a government that has already been caught lying about the same issue? And even if their intentions in this area were completely pure, government and business track records on securing any type of mass data collection have been abysmal. So here is something that can determine your ability to buy or sell or have a job. And so it's put some in mind of what the book of Revelation 13 and verse 17 says about the mark of the beast. And that which says that no man might buy or sell save that he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So should Christians be worried about this passport? Well, there are certainly general biblical principles that should cause us to be very worried. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9 warns us, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? You give flawed human beings with their evil human hearts this kind of power and ability to track and control the lives of others, and they will abuse it." America's founding fathers had enough Bible knowledge to know this. It's what prompted them to limit and check government's power. But is the vaccine or the vaccine passport the mark? And that's a critical question. The Bible promises terrible curses for those who receive the mark of the beast. Revelation chapter 14, verse 9 to 10, for example, warns that if anyone receives this mark, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God. So, are those that take this passport at risk of that? Well, we don't have to guess. The Bible tells us exactly what the mark is, but we must be willing to look into it. We have a free book, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, that goes through and proves in detail what this mark is. It will show you that this mark revolves around a question of obedience to God's law. This isn't about somebody being tricked or scared by the government into receiving a vaccine. You know, that decision would certainly carry consequences. But this mark revolves around a question of God's law. So Mr. Armstrong proves exactly what that is in that book, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? And I'd really encourage you to get that and prove for yourself what this mark is, what it is talking about. And it's not specifically this vaccine passport. But that's not to say that the COVID passport has nothing to do with the mark of the beast. If governments around the world succeed in setting up this kind of system, well, it could easily be used to enforce this kind of mark. You know, maybe at first the app only excludes the unvaccinated. But once that infrastructure is set up, well, then it could easily be expanded to exclude those who've fallen foul of the government in other ways. And there is a lot of opposition to these kind of vaccine passports. And if those opponents are successful and these kind of passes are stopped, well, look how much liberty we have already lost over the course of the pandemic. You know, the foot will be in the door for this idea. Another assault on liberty in order to implement this mark will be that much more easier. So this is a question that we do need to understand and understand quickly. And Mr. Armstrong helps you do that in his book, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast?
Thank you very much for that, Richard. I think the that question about the mark of the beast, it does seem like that is on some people's minds. It's been raised in internet forums and so on. To me, given the larger question of authoritarianism is one that is really problematic in the way that you see governments treating this, their COVID response here. You were mentioning just how these British leaders were saying one thing and doing another. They were insisting that this was not a part of their plans. No COVID passports. We would never do anything like that. And it seems like this is emblematic of the way that they approach so many things, that the left is, they are very willing to do whatever means are necessary. All of that is justified by whatever ends they are pursuing, and there's no underlying moral scruples. There's nothing to really restrain them once they have it in their mind that this is something that they need to do. It's just really an extraordinary illustration of that that lack of principle.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating thing to see play out, and I do think maybe there's two different types of things at play here when in the United States versus the United Kingdom. I mean, in the US you have a radical left that is in charge and that has over the course of many years been looking to kind of take advantage of anything and spoken quite openly about trying to take advantage of anything that they can to further that agenda. And this is something that is fundamentally part of the radical left. I mean, it's something that it sounds a bit of a different subject, but Hans Morgenthau in his book Politics and Politics Among Nations, this international relations textbook, he has a section in there talking about the nationalistic universalism of communism that kind of exalts the good of communism above all other moral limitations. And that you kind of, communism does this, fascism does this, where what is good for that ideology or for the state that practices that ideology is exalted above every other moral restraint. And the result that he focuses on is that states are willing to do things that would previously be considered, that other states would have not done in the past, mm-hmm. would have ruled too immoral, like killing 6 million Jews that you saw with the Nazis or 10 million Ukrainians like you saw with the communists. You see a similar kind of mindset, I think, within the radical left. Then what you see in Britain, I think, is something different. For the radical left, if you bring in communist utopia, it doesn't matter the means that you did that or how many people that you killed, because you're bringing in an eternal utopia. That is communism. But in Britain, we have a conservative government, a government that is nominally right-wing. And I don't think Boris Johnson is some kind of undercover communist spy or something, even though he may act like it. And I think what you see in Britain is the triumph of safetyism. And it's just this idea of the government's responsibility is to keep us safe at any cost. And it sounds nice, but the results of safetyism are as bad as any other kind of totalitarianism, and ultimately pretty indistinguishable from what the radical left is trying to do.
That's a great point. It does show the quite a change from the glory days of British Empire, where they were storming the barricades all over the earth, and the fact that we're holing up in our apartments and trying to keep ourselves safe from every conceivable threat to our health is a real sign of just how far Britain has fallen. I think too, we're talking about just the loss of freedoms with respect to the government getting hold of all of our biometrics and so on. But there's also this element of, if you disagree with a vaccine, if you are opposed to the use of a vaccine, that is there's no respect for that individual choice. It's basically the government says, for the sake of the greater good, in spite of all evidence to the contrary, there may be real validity to some of the concerns about the vaccine. This is the orthodox view, and you are not allowed to depart from it.
Yeah, we've seen this kind of censorship culture again in so many different areas when it doesn't even come to something like the vaccine. But it's like that has invaded our instincts now, to the point that no matter what the subject somebody is disagreeing on, the instinct is to shut them down. And yeah, you criticize the vaccine, and it used to be, even if somebody's opinion was crazy and we disagreed with them, the instinct was you argued with them, you debated, you brought your evidence, your reason, and you proved that you were right. And I think you think back to debate used to be a big thing in British and American culture. You think to the crowds that would turn out to hear the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and they'd stand and watch two people give hour and a half speeches. And that was how you got rid of your opponent. Now, if we have debates, they're 30-second zingers. And instead, you just try to silence your opponent. Mm-hmm. And you see that everywhere. And then that's just instinctively, when it comes to vaccines, that's what we do. Make them shut up.
Right. Well, it's quite an extraordinary development. We'll keep our eyes on it. And this is really something that will be affecting the lives of all of our listeners soon, I'm sure. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the development of vaccine passports. He's working on an article for the next edition of The Trumpet about this, and specifically how it may, whether or not it fulfills the biblical prophecy of the mark of the beast. You can watch for that at thetrumpet.com. We really appreciate your time, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Recently, I decided to go 1 month with no coffee, just to make sure I could. I didn't think it would be hard. I don't drink a lot of coffee, but I do enjoy it. I have one cup in the morning as I do Bible study, literally one cup, not a cauldron-sized mug that can fit a gallon of Joe. The smell, the taste, the warmth, it's a wonderful treat, but I indulge in moderation. During that month, however, I was dumbfounded at how much I thought about coffee. Before dropping off to sleep at night, I would have a pang of regret thinking of the beverageless study awaiting in the morning. I would pass Coffee Creek Road just a few miles from our house and think, that sounds delicious. I don't believe coffee is a sin, although it could be, but this experience did get me thinking about how powerful sin can be. In Romans 6 and verse 14, the Apostle Paul made this profound statement: sin shall not have dominion over you. Sin is an extensive, spreading, multiplying, malignant cancer in our world. It pours from the mind of Satan, from the minds of others, from our very own thoughts. This insidious evil power dominates everything, everywhere, every day, and you have the duty and the mission to stand against it. You're called not just to battle, but to a lifelong war against sin. In your mind, you must not only smash the chains of sin, but escape its entire dominion. If you cut a sin from your life, and yet you still find yourself yearning for it, that sin still has a type of dominion over you. You've denied yourself from gratifying that wrong desire, but you still have to fight off that yearning to see, hear, think, or do something wrong. It's to be expected that a lifelong habit will take time to die off, but that yearning is a type of dominion. It's something that must be healed in your mind, whether it takes days or years. Verse 12 says, "Let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in the lusts thereof." Herbert W. Armstrong talked about this issue in the March 1979 Good News. He said this, "Listen, my children, in the living Christ, do you really want to smoke, want to have birthday parties, want to go along with this world in its ways? Is that what you really want to do? Do you have to use self-resistance, self-discipline, and willpower to prevent going along in this world's ways?" Now, I'm sure something like smoking holds little temptation for someone who's been in God's church for a long time, but there are maybe other areas in your life where the world's ways do hold some appeal, areas where you do have to exercise self-resistance and self-discipline and willpower to keep them in check. And again, there are areas where, like coffee, a moderate amount of itself is not a sin, but there is a principle worth contemplating here. Now think about what Mr. Armstrong wrote in this article. He challenges us to compare our attitude about these things to God's attitude. He wrote, "Does God really want to sin, but because he has willpower of resistance, he uses willpower and does not allow himself to sin?" And this is his answer. "Can you realize that sin is absolutely abhorrent to God? God does not want to sin. He has no such desire. He hates sin. He's not tempted to sin. God loves and desires righteousness and holiness. That's what he loves, desires, and does." Well, that's God's attitude. How does it compare to yours and to mine? That pull we feel from worldly things is actually a measure of the world's hold on us, and in a sense of sin's dominion over us. Now, take a listen how Mr. Armstrong followed up. After asking if you have to exercise self-discipline to resist sin, he wrote, "If so, you have not yet been really conquered by the all-loving God. If so, you do not yet have the mind of Christ or his attitude or approach to problems or questions. If so, you'd better begin trembling at the word of God." Those are strong words. God doesn't want us hungering or thirsting for the world, having to exercise willpower to avoid giving in to those yearnings. He wants us hungering and thirsting for righteousness and holiness. That's what he says in Matthew 5 and verse 6. Mr. Armstrong said, "You can't have both attitudes. You have one or the other. Which is it?" Now, this might seem daunting. It feels hard enough to shake off the shackles of a persistent sin that you've been struggling with, let alone to fully conquer the temptation as well. But you do have help. Ask God to help you eliminate even the desire for sin. Plead with him to change your thinking and your desires to make them just like his own. Strive to become more and more like God, to the point where sin has absolutely no dominion over you. Go to war every day like a resistance fighter who believes in his cause, and God will give you the power to overcome temptation, to conquer sins left and right, to experience a change in your life that is nothing short of revolutionary. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Herbert W. Armstrong. "The only hope of justice, of peace, of truth, of right solutions to all this world's problems is the coming in power and glory of Christ to set up world government, right government, the government of God. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.